The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
And I'm delighted now to be joined in the studio by Irish author, Sunday Times bestseller John Connolly, who has recently released his latest book in his Charlie Parker series called A River Red with Blood. John, you're very welcome.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
And you've very exciting news to tell us about all of these fancy stars.
Do I?
You do. Yeah. Come, I know it's probably been around in your life for a long time, that the Amazon, the TV deal, the Charlie Parker deal. But for the rest of us, it's like, God, fair play to him.
Well, the thing is, firstly, let's just say that it's far cheaper and easier not to make something than to make something. And we've been at various stages of things before. But yeah, I tell you, where we are is we're kind of in the middle of the process where Amazon and Blumhouse have signed on, and we have a number of producers, including Colin Farrell and his sister and Bryan Cranston. And now what they have to do, and I had to ask about this because I was completely unfamiliar with it. They now have to recruit a showrunner, and the showrunner writes a pilot episode. And if the pilot episode passes muster, and he also has to do an outline of an initial season and then in theory, four seasons after that. And if all of that passes muster, they might then put money on the table to make a pilot episode. But as you know, Game of Thrones is a very salutary lesson for any writer who wants to get involved in television, because two things happened. Firstly, when they tried to make a sequel to Game of Thrones, they got to the pilot stage and they made a pilot and they put a lot of money into it and they cast it and they ditched it because they watched it and thought it didn't work. So you can get to that stage.
Yes, you can't rely on it
happening. Yeah, and it doesn't happen. And the other thing is I had to tell the... They wanted to do something interesting, which was why I was... It appealed to me. In that they wanted to reorganise all the material. They didn't want something that was going to be like Lost that stretched on forever and disappointed people at the end. So they wanted five seasons. They were going to reorganise 20 books, pick and choose material, and they wanted the ending.
Oh, no.
Which I hadn't told my wife.
But you had an ending.
Yeah, but I had a destination, but I didn't know the route I was going to take to it. And so I then have again the George R. R. Martin situation, which is what happened with him, was that television overtook the material that he had in hand. So the television overtook his books. And he had obviously sat down with them at some point, as I had, and said, look, here's what I'm planning. But then when it came down to it, nobody liked his ending. And I think poor old George R. R. Martin got creatively stymied at that stage, because what do? You have a series that's incomplete. Nobody liked the ending that you came up with. You kind of kick that ball down the road and hope maybe God takes you so you don't have to worry about it.
And has anyone given you feedback on your proposed
I am the least important person in this process, genuinely. I'm the person who sits at home and occasionally somebody makes a telephone call and asks me something. I did have to go through the books and really find material that I thought would be useful for them, rather than have some poor guy or girl have to sit down with 3 million words of my deathless prose and wade through it. So I kind of did a lot of the hard work there and picked and chose things. But genuinely, one would be very unwise to go putting down a deposit on a yacht at this stage.
Yeah, you're not doing that.
No, I'm not. And if it happens, wonderful. But and everybody is very well intentioned. But no, these things, there is many a slip between cup and lip in television and cinema.
So I take it then you don't know if Colin will be in it or Bryan Cranston will be in it.
I have not had that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, I always ask authors this when there's a prospect of something transferring to the screen. Does Charlie have to look for you like the Charlie that you have lived with for all of these years in your mind?
You mean me taller but better looking?
Oh, really? That person, is that what he looks like?
That person. You know, again, those things are very much out of your hands. To pick a lesson from another writer, I remember Lawrence Block sold his Burglar series to cinema. And the Burglar, he was kind of a rumpled Jewish guy, I think. And you would have thought Dustin Hoffman. And when they made the film, it was Whoopi Goldberg. Now, that's probably about, you know, it sounds like a Jewish name, but that's about as far as we're getting from it. So writers really have, I think one of the errors writers make as well is to go into this situation thinking you have any input.
You just have to hand it over.
Well, you really don't. Even one way or the other, the real people with who are important are the people who are paying the money for it. You know, and if you're putting, as it would be in this thing, if you're talking about five seasons of television, that's millions and millions of dollars. The final decision is theirs.
So you have to go through this thing in your mind as the creator of this, that I am handing over my work. And is that okay with you?
It is, because I trust the people involved entirely. But also, like I said, they were doing something interesting. They weren't simply saying, well, we're going to take a book, we're going to do this book and then that book and we'll do it in a linear way. Somebody was going to disassemble all this material and create something very different. And I think that's what appeals to me. To look at those early Harry Potter films, where they were so beholden to J.K. Rowling, I think, that they were afraid to take anything out.
Yes.
And they're poorly paced. And again, writers who want to see their work transferred directly to the screen are going to be disappointed. These are two very different mediums.
Although the Harry Potter films run on a loop in my house.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And they're perfectly entertaining.
Yes. You know? Can we watch the darker ones, the later
you
ones?
You can probably star in it by now. You can recite large tracts of it.
Yeah, I know. I know. I can. I really can. Listen, your book, this most recent one, deals with this phenomenon that I don't think most of us would know about that happens in the States with troubled teens and where they go and where they're sent.
Well, there's been more of it lately. I think there's been a couple of quite nasty documentaries about it. But essentially, it's that odd business of parents deciding that teenagers they regard as troubled. Now, what your definition of a troubled teenager and mine may be very, very different. But we're often talking about kids who might be smoking a bit of pot or who don't want to go to school or are listening to Marilyn Manson, in which case, really nothing wrong with them. A spell in the army won't cure. But the idea of sending blokes to your house in the middle of the night, throwing them into the back of a van with restrained while they're screaming for their parents and saying they're sorry, and then driving them into the wilderness, essentially giving them the summer camp from hell, for anything from 2 or 3 weeks up to months and months and months, essentially redirecting their education, seems to me just a huge abrogation of parental responsibility.
And who's making the decision? The parents are
making the decision.
And who's running the schools?
They're private. They're not. Technically, they're monitored. But when I began writing about the school in the book, one of the wonderful things about Maine is that, because my books are set there, no matter how odd a thing I come up with in my imagination, someone in Maine has done something odder. And there's often a picture of them doing the odd thing. And there had been a series of schools in Maine called the Elan Schools, and they were set up, I think, at the end of the 70s, and lasted, really persisted until the start of this century. And were so horrendous, although in theory they were under supervision, were so horrendously run that children died. One of the modes of therapy was to have boys beat each other in a boxing ring. And so one boy was beaten to death. It was a mixed-sex school. One girl was so distraught, she ran away, was abducted by a serial killer and killed. It was a nightmare. Children being buried in unmarked graves. There was just no supervision at all. But I find, if there are so many parents listening to your show, there isn't a parent out there who at some point hasn't had to step out of the room with a child and kind of go, I will murder you. You know, I just need, just keep quiet. I will go outside. I am the adult here. And, you know, you get over it. And I had to interview Wilbur Smith many years ago. The writer Wilbur Smith, and he had a famously fractious relationship with his daughter, and they were completely estranged. And I think he would have been in his 70s or 80s when I met him. And his daughter, who was now a young adult, had travelled back from wherever she was, and I think she was in Europe, and she'd hitchhiked and travelled at her own expense, and then walked all the way up to his ranch, the door of his ranch in South Africa, and knocked on the door in an attempt to reconcile. And he opened the door, looked at her, and closed the door again. And she turned around and walked back all the way she came. And I said to him, is that true? Because I read that. Is that true? And he said, yeah, it's true. And I said, but how, as a parent, how could you do that? And he said, well, I'm not trained to deal with problem children. And you kind of want to go, well, which of us? Did we get a manual at the beginning? Which of
no
us
one
is
gave
trained
it to me.
To
did you get it?
No, I didn't get it either. I wish somebody got it. And I understand, yes, there are points at which some children become very difficult. I have a friend who's a special needs assistant. While back, I had to get a tetanus jab after being bitten by a child. You know, there are troubled children out there. But by and large, the children who have been put in these situations are not troubled. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what it does to the mindset of a child who's already not entirely happy with their parents if they suddenly get dumped in the wilderness.
Do you know what I'm thinking about?
I wouldn't even want to go to the Gaeltacht, you know?
Do you remember Paris Hilton wrote about this recently or came out recently? It sounds like the school that she was sent to was something akin to what you're just describing.
Sure. And she, obviously, her 20s and subsequent years they seemed like a bit of a social nightmare as far as I can tell. You know, and she seems to have come out of it at the other end, but it clearly didn't help her. I just find that idea that parents would, either out of desperation or just not caring enough, would hand their children over to strangers in that manner. I find it extraordinary.
Well, what a great place to start your story or to set the story or to use it.
Yeah, and actually, I'd begun writing the book before I knew that the Elan Schools existed. So there was a resonance there for people in Maine who go, actually, there's nothing here that we haven't seen already. And actually, we've seen worse.
So Maine then is where you go to write. Is that right?
Yeah, and where the books are set. Yeah. I worked there when I was younger and I wanted to give Parker an affection for a place that I had an affection for. And also, it wasn't colonized in the way that New York was or Boston was. There were no crime writers really writing about Maine. It was a virgin landscape. Mm.
Now you have the whole of Ireland going, now that Amazon are going to make it, why didn't you do it in Ireland, you know?
Yeah, well, I suppose
we'll all be here now in 2 years' time.
Sorry, sorry.
But how do you feel about America right now?
cautious when I go over. Most of my neighbours, Maine is an interesting state in that way, in that it has a couple of very, very liberal cities, but most of it is a red state. So once you get outside, it's very, very conservative. Most people just don't talk about it.
I hear that so much, and you hear that from people who work for multinationals here, that if they go on a business trip, you just do not talk about
politics.
Well, you're
often told, don't talk about religion and politics at the dinner table, and I think that's extended to American society. Now, you're not going to change anybody's mind. You know, the two extremes are too far away. And all you're working with is that little group in the middle who swing with each election, seemingly according to the economic wind, or whether they just detest the whatever the current regime is, that whether they detest it enough.
But do you see evidence of this Trump era in terms of people being concerned about being lifted by ICE or whatever it might be?
Well, I was in Maine in April, and so many of the stores there had signs in the window saying, if you see ICE, call this number. You know, it was a central number you could call so that they could alert other people, and it went out on social media. And a lot of them had warnings to say, you can't come in here unless you've got a warrant, because Maine, being a vacation state, runs on immigrants. You know, it runs on people who come in and work for low wages and clean hotel rooms and work in fast food joints and lobster shacks. And so it's destabilizing that economy, because a lot of people who are even legitimately entitled to be there were afraid to go out to work, because, you know, the profiling is racial. They're not stopping white middle-aged guys like me and asking me whether I have a visa.
Yes.
They're stopping black people and Latinos and saying, well, you know, do you have a right to be here? And then you have to prove it. And how many of them are going to carry their papers everywhere? I don't carry a passport when I go to the United States. You'd be afraid you'd lose it. You might keep a copy on your phone, but that won't satisfy them.
But you could now be asked for it, you know.
Okay, and yes, and they did. ICE were at the shuttle for the bus that takes people from Portland to Boston, checking everybody's passport as they were getting on it.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that can happen now, of course, is your social media being checked as you
I would have to look very seriously at it I don't think those measures will go through, those ESTA measures. I just think it would be so awful for tourism and for business if they were to go through. Some watered down version of it will probably go through. Good luck on my social media. There's nothing interesting on it. Cats falling off tables and pictures of dogs.
Well, you think that, but then you see when we all have a look, you know, there are certain messages that you might have been.
So what have you been doing?
don't check my hard drive, John.
All right. I'll come as a character witness if anything happens.
Listen, we're coming into literary festival season, and I read an interview which I really smiled at, where you were talking about having no issue with being up on the stage, but it was the chatting to the other writers that sometimes gets you.
I've had a couple of run-ins with people who I won't mention, and I just think, no, I'd rather be at home with my, that social aspect of it is less important to me, and I think that's a function of getting older as well. When I was younger, it was great fun, and now as I get older, I don't want to be trapped with writers.
But you know, as publishing becomes a little more challenged, and you know, there's more out there to entertain us, it is really important, I'm sure you find this, to meet the readers.
Oh, that part of it I love. But readers and booksellers and librarians, why wouldn't you want to talk to people who read? And there are, it's not a huge group of people who are passionate readers. You know, increasingly that's an issue we have to address. I am optimistic, though. I look at the next generation coming up and see, I have bookseller friends, and they've been kept going by teenagers and people in their 20s coming in and buying physical books. That period of people wanting to read on screens is largely dominated by middle-aged people. You know, middle-aged people own Kindles and middle-aged people download books, and younger people have become increasingly fascinated with the artifact of physical media. And having a cultural marker in your life, having the book that you love on your shelf, having the album that you like on your shelf, rather than having it lost in this kind of digital morass.
I had this experience with a William Trevor book years and years ago that I downloaded onto my Kindle, and I loved it so much that I went out and bought it a second time. And I thought, I'm such a fool. I'm now buying this book twice because I want to have the physical copy because I loved it.
Well, I think so many of us who love books keep books that we've loved from childhood, or books that were given to us by somebody, or books we associate with a particular time in our life. And it's that particular copy of the book, not that you want a new copy of it, it's that battered copy you had as a teenager, that battered copy when you fell out of love with somebody. And when you see it, you get this little rush back. And those things are incredibly important in your life, those little cultural markers in your life. They will get you through very difficult times. And I remember writing a book about nostalgia. There is a department of nostalgia in the University of Southampton, which has spent a lot of time examining this. And they actually say, three times a week, for your mental health and your emotional health, pick up something that you loved in your childhood.
pick up a book or listen to a piece of music or watch a TV show that was important to you. And don't let anybody tell you that it's a guilty pleasure. Go and sit down and wallow in that. Now, the past is a lovely place to visit, but we don't always want to live there. But to take those time and to remain in touch with those things that were important to you all through your life are very, very good for your emotional health. And that's true, especially true, I think, for many of us of books.
Yeah, it's such a good idea. I mean, it sounds lovely, even the very idea.
Yeah, but they've tested that. One of the loveliest tests they did, they went into an old folks home and they put on films that these older people had loved, you know, the films from the era when they were young and getting married. And they put monitors on them and their body temperature went up. So that idea of the warm glow of nostalgia is actually a physical response to a psychological and emotional stimulus.
How do you feel about audiobooks?
Great. I think they're fantastic. I don't care how people read or what they read as long as they're reading. And audiobooks have actually brought in a constituency that we were struggling to reach, which was young men. Young men were difficult to convince to read. And now because they're doing commutes and there's only so long you can look at your phone, audiobooks have become a kind of constituency. Male readers have become a constituency. And that's something, again, we have to address in that young men read less. In general, people don't read a lot. I think the average person read 3 books in the UK. And I think that average was brought up by a small number of people who read an awful lot of books.
It
is, yeah. Some of that decline with young men has been arrested. I think the last time I read it, I think it was 36%. It used to be 36% of boys who hadn't read a book. It's gone down to 30%. But getting young men to read and to read fiction especially remains quite difficult. And I know there's a campaign in Irish bookstores to get people reading more fiction by women. And I think largely we've addressed that imbalance that was there for a very long time. If you look at the bestseller list now and publishing, women are the dominant force. And I think what we need to worry about is getting young male readers in. And we'll worry about what they're reading a little bit later, yes. But just to get them reading fiction.
So it doesn't matter to you if you're listening to a book. Sometimes I feel a bit guilty if I listen to something, and I listen to a lot. I generally have a hard copy book on the go and then I'll be listening to something else. And I feel like I'm cheating when I'm listening.
No, I think they're just different ways of engaging with a book, I think. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And actually, there's something lovely about it, particularly memoir. To read somebody describing their lives in the form of a book, I think is quite delightful. And it taps into something very atavistic in us. I think those of us who were read to as children, there's some element of that when we listen to something on a radio or listen to an audiobook. I think it goes back to something very deep and profound in us.
Has to be good, a lovely voice, though. If the voice isn't good,
well, you don't
want
someone
right
from Birmingham reading a book to you. No, that's not
going to
go. And not that there's anything wrong with people from Birmingham, he added.
So Charlie Parker, then, given that you had to tell these fancy TV people what's going to happen to him, is there an end in sight? Or
I think the books are certainly generally what happens with writers is they die. They just pop off the perch.
You die.
I'm not planning on it. You'll feel really bad if something happens to me when I leave now.
Really bad. I'll be saying I should have showed in my social media.
Yeah, actually, I could have bought a book. So I think what happens is generally writers of series just die. And if they're successful enough, the publishers will engage some hack to write his or her name in tiny little letters under the bottom and hope nobody's noticed that you're dead. I've always thought that the Parker books kind of represented chapters in a larger narrative, and I would like to finish that narrative. The challenge for writers is how to finish that without alienating readers, you know, depriving them of characters that they've loved and giving them an ending that's appropriate. And so that's what I'm aiming for.
Okay, but you're determined that you are going to do it.
Yes, unless, as I said, a piano falls on my head as I leave here, which my last words will be to curse you, Claire Byrne.
Great, John. It's ending so well. A listener says, I'm super excited for John's update for the new TV series because I've read all of his books and I cannot wait. She is a huge fan. And this is the thing. People who have grown up with Charlie Parker and who feel that they know him, they then will see this representation eventually on the screen, which just, it'll either fit or it won't. You know, that's the risk that you take with this thing.
True, but the books remain. You know, the books will be there.
You don't have to watch the TV thing if you don't want to.
Oh, no, I don't. Nobody does. No, that's absolutely it. But inevitably, more people will watch television than will ever read the books. So you do reach a different constituency. And I'm not sure those people necessarily go back and buy the books.
Yes.
But you are certainly introducing your world to a different audience.
Always good to read the book first, though, I think, don't you?
Speaking of somebody who prefers books, then yes, I would read the book first.
I'm with you on that. John, it's been lovely to have you.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you so much. John Connolly, and the new Charlie Parker book is called A River Red with Blood, and it is out now.
It is indeed.
Thank you, John. Lovely to have you. We'll take a break.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. conversation that counts.